All right, everyone, welcome to another episode of The Big Questions with Big John. I'm your host, Big John, of course, and today we have another interesting, fantastic guest that we're going to have a nice conversation with. Let me introduce this man by reading his bio. Dr. Benjamin Powell is a prominent economist and academic known for his expertise in free market economics, immigration, and global labor markets. He is the executive director of the Free Market Institute at Texas Tech University and a professor of economics in the Rawls College of Business. Dr. Powell has made significant contributions to economic research and policy discussions. Everyone, let's welcome Dr. Benjamin Powell. Dr. Powell, welcome to the show.
Hey, Big John, and feel free, just call me Ben. Let's have a conversation, man.
All right, man. Ben, it is. Fair enough. I love that. We're already off to a great start.
Well, we got plenty of time to screw it up.
There you go. There you go. All right, Ben, so let's start out with the basics. What got you interested in pursuing a career as an economics professor, theorist? Economics is typically not the first thing that, say, a high school student might say, hey, my life's dream is to grow up and be an economist. What set you down that path?
Yeah, no, certainly it wasn't. And I started off college majoring in something even more boring, accounting. Started taking more finance courses and econ courses, and I kept taking more of the econ, and eventually it became a minor, then a second major. And it was during college I went to an event that the Leadership Institute was hosting, and it was on it was more political really than it was economics, but they throw you books when you answer questions, and they threw me Capitalism and Freedom by Milton Friedman. And
of course.
I read that and I said, wow, this makes a lot more sense than the stuff I'm hearing from my kind of lefty economics professors at the University of Massachusetts. And I found out that Hayek was his colleague. So then I read Hayek. I found out Mises was his teacher, read Mises, then Rothbard, attended a summer seminar at Mises Institute, got into the stuff, and ended up at George Mason pursuing my PhD in economics. And here we are about 25 years later and live, eat, breathe this stuff, and have been doing it the whole time and love it.
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, I have to admit something. Milton Friedman was my entree into economic thought as well, and Capitalism and Freedom, but also his Free to Choose series, which I found fascinating. Now, a little bit on me, I never started out anything to do with economics, business, anything to do with money I found distasteful. Like my double major was in the sciences, biology and computer science. So I studiously avoided any of those business, the kids who went to business college or went to get their MBAs, you know. And then I just stumbled across some Milton Friedman. And then, you know, when you start going down that rabbit hole and you see his appearance on the Phil Donahue show, reading his stuff on the back of Newsweek or whatever, and then reading Capitalism and Freedom and Free to Choose. So I kind of start, which is interesting because I never then went down the rabbit hole beyond Hayek. Like I kind of stopped at Hayek, the Schumpeters, like guys like that. Did you feel that it was the juxtaposition of what you said were your lefty economics professors, which is almost repetitive, right? But was it the juxtaposition of these liberal professors, and then here you are staring at someone like Friedman and Hayek, and then eventually Mises and Rothbard, where you said, like, this is actually spurring me on to pursue this even more? Or was it just the pure appeal of, say, free market economics and the Austrian school and things like that?
Yeah, I thought the ideas and the arguments were compelling, really. It better explained the world. That got me excited about economics. I've been doing it ever since. And in fact, you know, I remember I watched the old Free to Choose series with Friedman when I was an undergraduate. And for six seasons, I guess, here at Texas Tech, I co-hosted a TV show on the local PBS. It was called Free to Exchange, kind of inspired by his PBS one in the past.
Yeah, but you're not wearing like an Adam Smith necktie or the equivalent like he used to do on every TV show, right?
No, man. I worked in a bank in college when I had to wear a necktie. Now it's for presidents and big donors. That's about it.
Fair enough. So as you're pursuing economics and especially the Austrian economics, that field of economic theory, let me ask you this. Did your sort of political or ideological formulations come as a result of your economic exposures, or did which one informed which, or were they sort of concurrent?
Well, it's a two-way street, obviously, I think, for anybody. Broadly speaking, I had a classical liberal kind of worldview. I grew up in Massachusetts, a student of the American Revolution who would go to Lexington and Concord. So the American Revolution is essentially a libertarian idea. So that was in the background before I knew any economics, and those two things jive together fairly well. But I do think, like, when doing economic science, right, your ideology, your political worldview informs what you think are interesting questions. But it doesn't do the economic, it doesn't do the analysis. The economic science does the analysis. Your ideology inevitably impacts what you think are interesting questions.
Yeah, that's interesting. And I kind of like got drawn into that phrase economic science, right? So what's interesting is some of the Austrian economists that I've spoken to, when they kind of poo-poo the Milton Friedman, the Chicago school, right, they'll say, like, well, you know, Chicagoans tend to be empiricists, whereas, you know, they think there's a model for everything and everything needs to be rigorously tested and so forth, whereas Austrians are just look to describe the world as is and they believe in inherent truths in economics as opposed to having to test everything empirically. Do you feel that's like a fair statement?
All right. I don't know how down in the weeds you want me to get for your audience here, but I think a lot of Austrians overstate some of these things. So I think many Austrian insights are great. I use them in my own work and such, but I don't narrowly call myself an Austrian economist. I'm an economist and I use ideas from whichever previous thinkers I think inform the question at hand. When the Austrians, you can have Austrian theory, which they'll call a priori, and that is by definition in philosophy of science, not empirically testable. But you can have a priori theories that are irrelevant and that do not apply to the real world. So the role of empiricism is saying if your a priori theory actually has applications in the world, if your a priori theory isn't explaining and correlating with things in that are actually happening in the world, maybe you've done one that's irrelevant. Second, economic theory gives you directions. So, you know, demand curves slope down. It's in the nature of how we've defined the terms to begin with. But it doesn't tell you if they slope down like this or like this or like this. That's an empirical question. And the only way you get at that is with empirical analysis. So I think there's lots of interesting questions in the world that pure theory just doesn't give you a straight answer to. And it could be that also in lots of situations in the world, particularly if we're talking about complex things like economic development, growth of nations, that multiple things are happening at once, some that have theoretical consequences that go in one direction, some that go in another, and sussing out what's empirically more meaningful in terms of explaining the development of a country is not something you're going to answer with pure theory. That said, yeah. I don't think you can do empirical work without theory, because the very nature of what data is informed by what your theory is. So the far extreme in the opposite direction who says, oh, no, I don't believe in this theory, I'm just a data guy, it's bullshit. You either have ad hoc theory that informs your data, or you have systematic thinking. And I think economics gives us a systematic theoretical way of thinking about the world. And then disciplined social science also involves looking at empirical questions with those theories.
Yeah, it's interesting how people sometimes just assume that if you have a big enough computer or big enough cloud space, data will solve all your problems. Like that data can contextualize itself to whatever situation it is. And that's like, even in my business, I find that to be patently false. You know, like you can't just line up a whole bunch of formulas necessarily absent the context of why you're trying to derive what it is, you know, the answers from those formulas. So you consider yourself, would it be fair to say you consider yourself a little bit of a hybrid of all these different schools? Or like if someone said, hey, brand yourself as an economist, Ben, what would you tell them?
That I'm methodologically promiscuous.
I love that. That's like such a political answer, Ben.
I think there's lots of great ideas in economic science and over hundreds of years of development of it. And I don't define what I work on by a particular tool or method. Instead, I let what interesting question I'm working on define which set of tools I'm going to use to try to figure it out. And that said, I think there's lots of great tools in multiple sets that include Austrian a priori theory, that include traditional regression empirical analysis, more modern causal inference analysis, and depending on the question, that's what dictates the tools.
Excellent. Would you say there's any particular tools that are out there, and I'll avoid using air quotes for this, but are there any tools out there in the economist's handbag that you feel are inherently flawed, that basically don't apply in any situation?
Yeah, I mean, sure, there's lots of bad theories out there. In a more broad sense, sometimes people ask me, what type of economist are you, micro or macro? And I answer nonfiction, because microeconomics is basically nonfiction. Traditional macroeconomics is more fiction. But that's not to say that there aren't macro phenomena like unemployment, inflation, and all these things. It's just good explanations of these macro phenomena are ultimately rooted in the choices of individuals. And that means microeconomic foundations of macroeconomic phenomenon. So if I was going to speak broadly, yeah, I'm not into a lot of the mainstream macro stuff, but okay. well done, micro foundation macro is still cool.
Excellent. Okay. Now, you gave me an opportunity to do a good segue here, which is you seem to enjoy answering interesting questions. And then depending on the question you're pursuing, you'll decide what tool set to dip into to best try to answer those interesting questions. So let's based on some of the books you've written or co-authored, let me toss a couple of things at you here. So you co-authored a book on immigration with Alex Narasta. Mm-hmm. I always have trouble with that gentleman's name, and I had him on my show once and I still couldn't get his name right. I apologize to Alex. But the book was called Wretched Refuse, The Political Economy of Immigration and Institutions. Now, tell us a little bit about that. And what I would draw from that book is that you generally believe there's a net positive effect of immigration on a nation's economy. Is that correct? And how would you like to add to that?
Yeah, so let's try to parse this out a few ways. And actually, I can wrap it back into one of your previous questions, too. So, in general, I think immigration boosts the economy of the destination country, including the wealth on average of the native born population. Rather than being a drain on us, they create a gain for us. There's a huge economics literature that debates all sorts of various aspects of that. We can get into those things if you want, about jobs, wages, things like that. But this book was really about what I think is the most important question/objection to immigration from a destination country standpoint, because economist estimates of the economic gains from migration are jaw-droppingly massive. We're talking like if you went to a world of free migration and on average of doubling global GDP. Whatever other substantial problems, overcrowding, slums, tax strains, whatever you want to come up with like that, if we're really doubling global GDP, you have to be thoroughly uncreative to not figure out a way to solve those problems with a world that's twice as rich. The big question that we are trying to address in this book is, do immigrants bring some baggage with them that is responsible for the lack of productivity in their origin country and make the destination country a little bit more like the origin? So put this in very plain terms to make an obvious example. Socialism is responsible for Cuba's poverty. That's why Cubans aren't productive in Cuba. Cubans in Miami are very productive because they work in a mostly capitalist system in the United States. If Cubans leaving Cuba, moving to Florida, brought ideas that promoted socialism in Florida with them, that would not only not allow them to realize the big income gains, but it would drag down the productivity of existing Floridians and make them poor. So this is something that's called the new economic case for immigration restrictions. And it started with an economist at Harvard, George Borjas. I shouldn't say it started with him. It became most well-known through George Borjas from Harvard. In some sense, the idea is one that's been there throughout American history. You can get quotes from Thomas Jefferson or Benjamin Franklin talking about, I'm kind of paraphrasing here, but basically, if foreigners come to the United States, they're either going to bring their status roots of home or a licentiousness that's incompatible with ordered liberty. It would be a miracle if they stop exactly at the point of our institutions. So it's gone, but what's new about it is the Borjas angle on it is that the productivity differences between origins and destination countries have to do, at least in part, with the institutions, formal and informal, that govern economic interactions. And those institutions are, at least in part, a product of the beliefs and the hearts and minds of the citizens there. So if one immigrant moves, they don't move their institutions with them. They just come and they get the economic gains. But if a lot of them move, maybe they bring enough of these bad ideas with them, whatever they are. And they could just be cultural traits. They could be formal institutions. He's very nonspecific. And then what would that do to this doubling of global GDP? All of a sudden, does that shrink it? If it's bad enough, it could even turn it negative. So the question is, how much of that bad productivity from the origin country do they bring that spills over to the natives? And honestly, his paper on it, I think, is an example of kind of bad economics, because he asserted this case, kind of the intuitive one. Then he wrote a math model and did various assumptions of exactly how much of the bad stuff they brought, right, and said, look, it can destroy all the gains. Well, sure, I can make shit up and add math too. But there's actually no evidence in his new case for immigration restrictions that this does in fact happen. So Alex and I got talking and said, well, why don't we try to look for this? Now, since he's very general in it, and forget it, framing of him, just the question is very general anyway, we started actually, at first we just did one article and then it spilled to another and a few papers down the line. I think I was given an address at the Mont Pelerin Society, and one of the guys on the panel with me who edits a series at Cambridge University Press, he's like, do you have a book manuscript on this? I said, no, I got some articles. He's like, you should put this in a book manuscript and send it to me. And I got back and I was talking to Narastra. I'm like, all right, let's try to fill out the holes here of what do we think all the different things are. So what we did, we looked kind of across large numbers of countries and at individual case studies. And there's problems and advantages to doing both. So first thing, look at a large number of countries, look at the immigration stock in the country at a certain time period, let's say 1990. Let's look at the immigration inflow for the next 20 years. And we're going to look at economic freedom. So there's an index, Economic Freedom of the World annual report. You can find it on freetheworld.org. And we're going to say, what was their economic freedom score at the start of this period? What was the score at the end? What relationship did that have to the stock of immigrants at the start? The number who came in over that time, the interaction of the stock and the flow. And basically what we find is not a single case where we did it a whole bunch of different ways empirically. Right. We didn't find a single result that had the sign and significance that Borjar's claims in the new economic case. Nowhere did the economic freedom go down over that 20-year period. And quite often we found it improved with more immigrants coming in.
And was that independent of, so one of the criticisms you hear, surprisingly enough, even from libertarians, is that this time around, immigration is different. Like throughout the American history in particular, right, you've had the Know Nothing Party and things like that. You've mentioned Jefferson in some cases. There's always been, throughout our history, an objection to immigrant group blank, because this time it's different, right? So whether it was the Germans initially, the Irish, the Italians, the Greeks, the Asians, whatever, right? And one of the things that you'll find now in some libertarian circles is, well, we used to believe in open borders / free movement of people and services, but that would be absent the welfare state, right? That seems to be one of the common arguments people fall bar. Like, absent the welfare state, we'd have no objection. I mean, if you exclude Hoppe and his stuff, right? But if you were to say, like, hey, let's get rid of the welfare state, then we'd be more than happy to have open borders. But the presence of the welfare state, with all this immigration, is an undue drag on the rest of, say, particularly to the U.S. So did you find that the presence of, say, like you said, you looked at it by economic freedom, did you also take into account variables that, for example, the size and scope of the welfare state of the destination country?
Yeah. So in that empirical analysis, size of government is included in that. Okay. And but that's only part of it. I can better address this question. But also, one of the case studies we did in there was Israel in the 1990s. So the drawback to cross-country ones is you're dealing with more limited stocks and flows, and it's from controlled immigration. So it doesn't tell you, what if immigration gets really big? I mean, getting the slope of the start of a relationship is better than just making stuff up and adding math, but it doesn't tell you when the numbers get bigger. So we did individual case studies, and one of them where you had big mass migrations. And one of them was Israel in the 1990s. where the population increased by 20% due to immigration during the decade. And it was almost all immigrants from the former Soviet Union. So people with a 70-year history of lack of political and economic freedoms. And basically, we did a synthetic control analysis, it's called, but basically, and you can eyeball the data and see this, because in fact, it was an email with Borhars after I sent him one of my other papers, where he said, what I'd like to see is an exogenous shock, a large exogenous shock, and what happens to the institutions. And I'm like reading and I'm like, duh, Israel, because economists have used that surge to study housing prices, labor market impacts, all sorts of things. So boom, what a massive increase in economic freedom. They go from something like 30% below the global average to 30% above the global average. And when you read the sociologists and people studying Israeli politics, basically, sometimes your empirical evidence, like, it's very simple. In reading this, like, the Labour, more socialist party, ceased using the color red in their political advertisements because they didn't want to alienate the former Soviet voters. And these are all voters, by the way, because of the law of return in Israel. They have instant citizenship if you're the descendant of a Jewish person, even if you're, and most of these immigrants were agnostics or atheists. So
they had a direct hand immediately in the way government performed, is what you're saying, right?
Yes, it formed their own political parties, became part of a ruling coalition that implemented economic reforms. But when we decompose the economic freedom there, what you see during that decade, four of the five areas of economic freedom improve, one gets worse, and it's size of government. But when you dig into it, what happens is they were all instantly eligible for the welfare state. And when they first migrated, transfers increased. By definition, that's going to bring your size of government score. Now, policy didn't change, just the amount transferred did. You look a decade later, once they're economically integrated, government size of government score rebounded back to where it was because policy didn't change. It was just the transfers. So that's one part. But the other part more generally, and this is not the institutions question, it's the welfare state question. I think that's probably relevant for a lot of your libertarian or conservative audience.
Yeah,
is good news. If that's really your only objection is that they're going to be net tax takers, we can drastically increase legal immigration right now because the vast majority of them are net tax positives. So all, basically it's by age, all young immigrants are net tax positive. So this, by the way, there's a right simple way to do this that's wrong. You can add the tax dollars up that they pay and the government services they receive and get a number. It's simple, it's accurate, and it's misleading. So I have a 14-year-old boy who's outside fishing right now, I think. He goes to a public school, doesn't generate much in tax revenue. He's a net tax drain, but that's not the right way to think about his tax impact. It's how much is he going to be a tax drain while he's in school? What is it going to be his taxpayer profile over life? If Social Security exists when he dies, what's going to be his net tax take then? Do this all back to present value terms. And look at any ripple effects in the economy of other people paying taxes because of him. Like in an immigrant's case, their employer hires them because the employer is going to be more profitable. That generates tax revenue at the firm level. Do all those things, present value it. And what you find with immigrants under current U.S. policies is all of the young ones are net tax gains. High skill as they get older remain net tax gains. Low skill old immigrants are the ones who are usually a net tax drain. So that means if your libertarian objection is just the welfare state, you can drastically liberalize immigration for young workers who want to come and for high-skilled people of most ages. And that would be a dramatic shift in policy. And if that's all I get from you for moving from saying, well, we just can't have immigration from the welfare state, we've made the world and ourselves a much better place.
Yeah, and I had, you know, you touched on it, and obviously thank you for your answer. I find it very strange that people now calling themselves libertarians are so anti-immigration. Not all libertarians, obviously a certain particular faction of them. They tend to cite Hoppe as the philosophical foundation for why they would be anti-immigration. Do you have any thoughts on that? If we could show that it's not that greatly liberalized immigration to the U.S. would not result in an impaired economy or a net drain economically. What is the objection, do you think? Why is it so? And it, I mean, it's always, there's a strain that's always been there, but why do you think it's picked up so much steam in recent years?
Well, and I'm not commenting on anybody specifically here, but there tends to be a with immigration, when I interact and someone's and I ask, well, what's your big reservation? And if I then explain some social science that makes that not really a concern, they switch what their reservation is. And this can go in a chain. And, you know, it root in many cases, it's just some version of racism or not wanting poor people around because on net, the immigrants are poorer, at least to start with. And they don't want to say that. They say, and I don't even mean intentionally, but they stick on something else in their mind that's right. The reason why and keep cycling through these. Now, the ones who are libertarian, and we'll talk about property rights stuff, which is a variant of some of the, I think they're really messed up on this. Because with property rights comes freedom of association. Existing policy that doesn't allow immigrants to come in violates not immigrant rights, but the rights of property owners in the United States to freely associate on their property with whoever they would want, as an employee, as a renter, as someone to sell to. They're basically doing international planning of the, central planning of the international labor market and trying to do that at our nation's borders. And I don't think we can do that any better than the Soviets could centrally plan the number of shoes to make. They'll talk about public property. And I think this is, for the most part, immigrants don't come and stay on public property. They go across it just like every American does to get to somebody else's property where you interact on private property. The welfare state and this tend to be two things that get mixed together. And I think libertarians just kind of get confused over a small part of it versus the big picture on it in terms of human liberty and the rights of existing people in the country.
Yeah, ironically, I didn't think of it until like you just answered, which is in a way, they're trying to impose a bit of the New World Order that they so vehemently object to in every other case, right? Because like I never thought of it as centrally planning the global labor market. I never really, that phrase you used just resonated with me all of a sudden. So
yeah, and I mean, even with the standard economists who aren't libertarian like this, and they'll point to like the Canadian system and say, well, look, their point system works. You get points for education, points for language ability, and all these. I'm like, what do you mean works? I mean, it impacts who gets in.
Right.
The idea that they're somehow getting the optimal mix of immigrants for the needs of existing Canadians is utterly ridiculous. You can't centrally plan this market any more than you can any other one. My own view is, as long as we're going to have governments and you're going to have something like immigration, going back to Ellis Island style immigration is roughly the correct policy. So scanning for contagious diseases that we've eradicated here, known criminals and terrorists, things like that at the border, but just not having quantitative and category controls. But as long as you're going to have a quantitative control, the closest you can come to finding the right mix is have a market. So if the number is going to be, it's about 2.5 million people who legally immigrate to the United States a year now. If that's going to be your number, take that number, divide it by 352 days in the year. That's how many permits you auction off every day. And whatever the price is, that's going to be about your efficient mix. The quantity is going to be wrong because we don't know the right quantity.
Right.
But conditional on getting quantity wrong, the mix will be as close. So that way there, you know what? Because otherwise, how do you reconcile Microsoft needs another H-1B visa worker and someone wants to reunite with their Vietnamese cousin? I know how you reconcile competing demands for a scarce resource. You let them bid against each other and you find out who values it more. Yeah. And for that matter, if you're an immigration restrictionist, let Hoppy buy some permits and burn them. You know, do what you will here.
Well, what's interesting there is a friend of mine who happens to be a libertarian attorney said to me, he goes, you know, the greatest thing we could ask for is for more poor people to immigrate to the United States, because who do you want? People hungry to escape the crushing poverty and the restrictive society they most likely came from compared to the U.S.? Or do you want people who don't have that hunger, don't have that passion, of who may just be moving here, say, for a less driven reason?
Two thoughts related to that, because usually it's low-skill immigration that's more controversial. But when I look at the United States and think about the mix of the labor force here compared to global scarcities, we have a shortage of low-skill labor. As a result, we overinvest in capital that replaces low-skill labor that should be capital created elsewhere. We have particularly women in their 20s and early 30s who leave the workforce, who are highly educated and highly skilled to do childcare activity that if we had a bigger pool of nannies from low-skill labor, would free up high-skill labor here to do more. So there's a economic mismatch going on. But then, two, on the kind of social front of the migration, and this is the, you know, economic freedom and the Cubans moving from Cuba to Florida. I can think of no better anti-socialist voting bloc in the United States.
Oh my goodness, no.
Than Cuban immigrants. And I think what we pick up in our results, that's a particularly extreme example of it. But I think there's something to that that generalizes, though, of America still means something to the rest of the world. And people come here with beliefs about freedom that they lack in their home country. And maybe nudge us a little bit more in that direction. And I certainly see it, by the way, in interstate migration. I'm in the great Republic of Texas. And people like to complain about all these Californians coming and moving into Texas. Man, when you look at the statistics on this, they own guns at a higher rate than native-born Texans. They tend to, now, I don't think R&D is a great proxy for things, but it's what we got in this case. They vote Republican at a higher rate than native-born Texans do. It's a selection bias of who moves. Yes. So they don't represent the ideas of where they came from. They more self-identify with the ideas of where they moved to. And I'm a Massachusetts-born guy who moved to start the Free Market Institute at Texas Tech. And my wife used to work in the general counsel's office at the NRA. So okay. Any stereotype they had from liberal Massachusetts moving to Texas is, no, I'm not.
Well, it seems to be logical to me that if you agreed with the policies of Massachusetts, you wouldn't be trying to leave Massachusetts, for example. And why pick Texas? For the most part, is because that's where you see your greatest either personal gain, emotional gain, or just happiness gain. So to me, it's just a natural conclusion that sometimes I just find it astonishing that other people don't see that. But
sure. And there's different degrees of this, right? So if it's just Californians escaping California's high cost of living, crime, and all the other crap. Well, you can go to Oregon, you can go to Seattle, you can go to Colorado, which is squishy purple. So, but if you choose Texas, that probably says something about your preferences.
Oh yeah, so you're making a statement, man.
Yeah. And there's other states, I think, where it's a little less clear about this. But Florida, I think, is also, I mean, COVID put this all on steroids of people who didn't like the statism in their origin states going to some relatively more free states. And I think there's a lot of selection bias, like pre-selection bias in who moves to where. And the same's true internationally. It's not the ones who benefit from their crony, corrupt states that they're coming from. It's the ones who are being oppressed by that and want to breathe a little bit more freedom.
Exactly. Yes, I agree with you. All right, great conversation. But I want to also move on to another book because I know we're a little crunch for time. So Out of Poverty, Sweatshops in the Global Economy. Now, what happens here is, you hear sweatshop, and reflexively, most people will be like, ick, horrible. We should have laws against sweatshops. We should have laws against child labor. We should have more minimum wage laws to make sure people can eat and live properly and have decent lives. And again, I think this is, again, more of a libertarian or a position, which is, what really is wrong with sweatshops?
Well, I mean, I think actually as humans, we can look at them and say there is something wrong with people living in poverty and having low living standards. But that doesn't mean that the answer is that we have to get rid of that by fiat. Instead, we have to get rid of that by creating greater opportunity. So when I look around the world, I can't see any country that is relatively wealthy today that didn't go through something like a sweatshop stage of economic development first. And by a sweatshop stage, I don't literally mean garment factories, although many places had them. But I mean, poor wages, harsh working conditions, long hours. You don't go from pre-industrial poverty. The history of humanity, right, is on about $2 to $3 a day maximum living standard. You don't go from that to advanced standard of living without going through this transition period.
Sure.
And the sweatshops themselves are part of what leads to the higher living standards. So proximate causes of higher living standards, human capital, physical capital, and technology. Underlying causes are better institutions of capitalism versus socialism and things like this, but the proximate ones. So once you have relatively good institutions, you need to accumulate these things. Well, what do sweatshops bring? Physical capital, technology, and relative to staying on the farm, opportunities to build your human capital. So this process in Great Britain plays out from, it's called about 150-year period from the late 1700s to early to mid 20th century before your post-sweatshop stage of development. For the United States, it's shorter, closer to 100 years, early 1830s to World War II-ish. And I grew up in this area. My hometown was Haverhill, Massachusetts, the shoe city for its 19th century women's shoe productions. And my undergraduate was at University of Massachusetts Lowell, among all those old factories. Well, why was our process quicker? Well, where did we get the technology? We stole it from Great Britain to start with. Where did we get the physical capital? Actually, British investors financed part of this. So when I think about the sweatshop countries post-World War II, this is your Hong Kong, Singapore, Japan to some extent, although they're the weird one, Taiwan, Korea, all of them, it's about a generation that they go from pre-industrial, all of those were, except Japan, were pre-industrial societies at the end of World War II, $2, $3, $4 standard of living. Right. And they're all wealthy first world nations by 1980. Japan was decimated, obviously, by the war, which is what pushed its standards back down, and it rebounded quickly. But the other ones had no history of being this rich country. Why did it go so much faster? Well, they got investment from the United States and other development countries that pushed capital in, pushed technology in. Whole process goes quicker, and they were all relatively economically free countries. That same process is playing out today in the countries that we see with sweatshops, China, Vietnam, India, Indonesia. So the first edition of Out of Poverty came out a little over a decade ago, and I just finished the copy edits for a second edition that's supposed to come out at the end of this year. And one of the things we did in the second edition is we went back and we looked at all the countries where we identified sweatshops and the wages they paid from 1995 to 2010, which was the data in the first edition of the book. And we said, how many of those countries have sweatshops reported in this next 10-year period? Answer is a lot of them drop off. You don't hear about it anymore. And of the ones that do, what happened to the sweatshop wages? And what you find is the sweatshop wages that are sweatshops in the 2010s pay vastly more than what were sweatshops in the 1990s and 2000s. Our definition of it expanded. And most of these countries experienced sustained increases in economic growth, reductions in poverty rates, decreases in child labor. Basically, the sweatshops, the transition is happening even quicker in a richer, more industrial world. Now, they're not a panacea. If you have crappy institutions that order economic activity, you don't have secure property rights, you're very corrupt, you don't have great freedoms, sweatshops are going to be like a crutch that's the least bad option. Workers choose to work in them because it's better than their alternatives. So we still shouldn't take them away. But it's going to be hard for that to generate a lot of economic growth. But for places like Vietnam that have been liberalizing a lot over the decades while it has sweatshops, they're just part of this transition that brings you to the higher living standards. So that's why the book's called Out of Poverty.
Right. So it just, like, and I mean, as would make sense to a lot of us, this is just some nasty tasting medicine to get towards, like, more and stronger economic output and greater economic freedom, right? Is like, hey, nobody likes the idea of having to work in a sweatshop, but the alternative is either unemployment and greater poverty, correct?
Yeah. I mean, if we, because we feel, let's say, icky buying the products of child labor, right? Why do children work? Children work because their parents are desperately poor, trying to feed, clothe, and shelter the family. That's why kids work. As soon as families get past the level where they can provide the calories and the food and shelter for the kids, kids drop out of the workforce. So if we see this, they'll go, oh, I don't feel good buying a product of child labor. It didn't end that kid and that family's poverty. It's just ended the way the family was best dealing with it. So we deal with the products they export. Most children who work in the world don't work in manufacturing. Most work in agriculture. Second most work in services. Agriculture, predominantly subsistence agriculture, and certainly not the stuff that's exported internationally. And services, that's like household cleaning services, gardening. Like, where do you think remuneration for children is better out of these three sectors? It's manufacturing. So when we stop buying the manufactured goods, the children go to other sectors to work where they earn less money, where they build less human capital, and in the case of ag, where their actual injury rates on the job are higher. And the families earn less as a result. So we make their poverty worse. And the same is true of sweatshop workers generally. We should interact with them, buy their products, agitate for greater free trade. If you care about the welfare of sweatshop workers, it's not that you can do nothing. So the process of development is ultimately what cures poverty. That's the big deal. But on the margin, we could lower tariffs against countries so that we can secure bigger gains from trade for both them and us. If you want to instantly create economic development for them, give them more visas. So if you take a Haitian out of Haiti and move them to the United States, their income goes up by 1,000% on average, like that. The process of development in sweatshops, it'll raise your incomes by 1,000%, but it's not like that. It has to accumulate over the years.
Right. No, that's fascinating. And you're right. I think if you look at it logically, there's no reason you would object to a voluntary sweatshop. So we're assuming there's no coercion to get like rounding up kids and having them, you know, work against their will.
Right. I think we have to distinguish between these two, and it's important because some people confuse them and call, oh, it's slave labor. No, it's low wage labor that people choose, admittedly from a bad set of options, but that choice means they think it's their least bad option. Right. Now, forced labor does exist and does exist in garment manufacturing, but it's not through the market enslavement. The big empirical case of this is the Uyghur province in China. It's the Chinese communist government that essentially enslaves workers in factories and produces things. And there, I think the appropriate response is to boycott or trade sanction. You want to dry up the demand for slave labor so fewer people are enslaved.
Right, exactly, exactly. Okay, and this final book that I'm going to throw out to you, to your book to discuss a little bit, which sounded like fun, actually, because it sounds like the way to get at people, right? Which was Socialism Sucks, Two Economists Drink Their Way Through the Unfree World. Now, talk to me a little bit about it. I mean, you ended up going to places, I believe, like Vietnam, Cuba, China? Yes? No?
China, the North Korean border on the Chinese side, Venezuela, Russia, Ukraine, Republic of Georgia.
Tell me a little bit about this. I keep hearing about the workers' paradises how wonderful it is there, and it's not being done right in the United States. That's why socialism has, Americans think socialism sucks because we don't do it right here. Having traveled to all these countries, are they doing it right? And does it work if you do it right?
Yeah, this feels weird to me to talk about this book now, because almost always when I do these interviews, I have a beer in my hand. So it's a very Anthony Bourdain style book. It's not an academic book like my other ones. It's a firsthand travel log as we tour these countries. But instead of talking about food like Bourdain, we talk about the history and operation of socialism in their past or in their current and the economics behind this while drinking beer. And the beer also serves as a metaphor for how these economies function, as it turns out, which wasn't something we intended when we started writing. We were just being honest about our travels. And it turned out, I was like, actually, this kind of tells a story. Yeah, so we start the tour in Sweden, and it's called Not Socialism, Sweden, because Sweden's mostly a market economy. They've got a big welfare state with lots of transfers. That's why they're not a perfect capitalist economy. But when you net everything together, they got strong private property rights, freedom to trade, sound money, low levels of regulation in most markets, not so much labor. Net all this out, they're in the top quarter of countries of the most economically free in the world.
Which shocks American liberals, right? Because that's all I hear is the success of Swedish socialism. That's to be distinguished from like a largely private free market economy with a large welfare state, right?
Yeah. And there's a consequence to the welfare state. Don't get me wrong. So Sweden adopted laissez-faire policy starting in the mid-19th century, grew rapidly to be the fourth richest nation in the world by 1950. Then in the 1960s and 70s, they put in their big welfare state. It's not socialism. It didn't decimate the place like Venezuela. But what it did do is it dragged down economic growth. And now they're in the bottom half of OECD countries in terms of their wealth. So there's a cost to a welfare state. It's lower growth. But I do think reasonable people could disagree about the desirability of slow growth and a welfare state versus faster growth and no welfare state in a way that reasonable people can't disagree about the functioning of an actual socialist economy. And by the way, the beer in Sweden is delicious. It just cost a fortune because they tax the hell out of everything to fund their welfare state.
Right.
Whereas Venezuela... So all of these things are on a scale, right? There's not a zero and a one of socialist capitalist. The most capitalist nation in the world isn't fully capitalist by an anarcho-capitalist definition. And the most socialist country in the world hasn't, you know, definition of socialism, right, is abolishing ownership, private ownership of the means of production. So the two closest attempts to all the way socialism the world's ever seen was the Soviet Union during the period of war communism, while Lenin was in charge at the beginning of his rule, and the Great Leap Forward under Mao in China. Those were probably your two most complete collectivizations that the world has seen. Even still, it wasn't 100%. And they were both utter disasters that cost lives. Venezuela is a mix. So there's nationalized things. The oil industry there is obviously nationalized. But there's also a lot of private ownership without private control, where the government, by fiat, controls what you can do with things that are nominally privately owned. And they didn't used to be like this. Venezuela used to be pretty economically free. In the 1950s, 60s, even by 1970, they were still very economically free. They were the richest country in Latin America. They were richer than Spain, its former colonizer. And then they started getting bigger, cronier government that grew over time and dragged them down till you get to the 1990s when Chavez, well, first he tried to a coup and got thrown in jail. But when he got out of jail, ran in a, what, as these things go, free and fair election. And international observers said it was a free and fair election then. And he ran on Bolivarian socialism. And he started putting these policies in place in Venezuela. And the socialists in the United States thought it was great during the 2000s. Oh, look, healthcare is improving. Poverty rates are going down. Incomes are going up. Well, Venezuela sits on the world's largest oil reserves. India and China were coming on the global market at that time, pushing oil prices up. We hadn't had our shale revolution yet to push back in the other direction. And Venezuela was tapping into that and basically selling government-owned oil to import goodies that made living statistics look like they were going up. But internally, the place was hollowing out. You get to 2013 when oil prices finally start to come down and the place implodes. This is shortly after Chavez's death, and it is what we have today. And so the big lesson with Venezuela is this is the rare one where it was democratic socialism. So it was democratically elected, and they put socialist policies in place. And, you know, Austrian economists will talk about how economic calculation under socialism is impossible. And I think that's a good argument and true. But there's another one, and it's having maintaining democratic freedom and socialism is also, it's not impossible, but it's highly, highly unlikely. Because once you centralize control of the means of production and you get this loss of both the economic calculation and incentive problems, you necessarily create economic stagnation. When you do that, voters push back against it. But once you've centralized economic power, you've centralized the ability to punish dissent. As a result, it's going to be a very rare person who just says, oh yeah, vote me out of office. And then the successor also says, vote me in and I'll keep the socialist policies. Instead, they use their power to crack down. And that's what Maduro has done there. Now, Venezuela is no longer a democratic socialism. And it's mere socialism or authoritarian socialism, just like every other one that's ever operated in the world. That's what the young democratic socialists in the United States don't seem to understand, is that that Sweden is not an example of democratic socialism, and that there is no example of successful democratic socialism because the incentives it creates makes it highly, highly unlikely for it to ever be able to sustain itself.
I agree, and I think that people who tout democratic socialism really don't understand what what it is they're trying to promote.
Yeah, and by the way, they basically ran out of beer production in Venezuela because they allocate the foreign exchange and they didn't give enough to the monopoly beer producer Polar to import the hops, and they don't grow hops domestically. As a result, no beer production. I don't know about you, but if I were a socialist dictator, like toilet paper, beer, these are the two things I'd make sure my place doesn't run out of.
Right, like plenty of vodka in the Soviet Union back in the day, right? Keep them all basically a nation of alcoholics. All right, interesting stuff. Very quickly, if I were to ask you to describe your ideology politically, culturally, what would be the answer to that?
I don't know, politically, culturally. I don't know about the culturally part, but...
Let's say politically, you would be a libertarian, right?
Yeah, I'm not a member of a political party, but in terms of broad ideological outlook, is it classical liberal, rightly understood, which... usually means libertarian in the United States today. Although some conservatives, if you ask George Will what conservatives, and I have asked him this, what does conservatism mean? He says conserving the principles of the American Revolution in the American sense. I'm like, well, that sounds like classical liberal or libertarian to me.
Right, right. Well, people forget that, they hear the word liberal and they assume leftist, not realizing that the American Revolution was rooted in liberalism. So properly understood, you would define yourself as a classical liberal as opposed to a minarchist. I don't think you're an anarchist or an ANCAP or an agorist or anything like that, right?
Well, I think those are interesting. So I think anarchism is an interesting research question for political economists. And that if you care about ideas of liberty and believe that that is a sustaining equilibrium, that would be something to strive for. But I don't spend too much time on debating. Well, actually, I've written on that stuff in scholarship a bit, including criticizing people who use the label minarchist because I think they're being thoroughly uncreative. Minarchists usually will define it by function. The government should just do defense, law, courts, maybe police.
Right.
Okay, well, those are functions. It doesn't tell you how much of them they do, because we already have arbitration and mediation in the United States and internationally. We already have private security, both of high quality and low quality. We already have examples of, at least on the margin, different national defense being privately provided. So any minarchist who cares about liberty should be thinking about how much could we scale back the minimal state so that it's less than minimal and only doing that which private government or private citizens wouldn't be doing among themselves anyway. And once you start doing that, you start peeling back awfully close to anarcho-capitalism, maybe.
Yeah, you do to some extent. I mean, I kind of oscillate between calling myself a classical liberal or a minarchist. And that question always comes up. Like, once you accept government in some form, what is too much? What is too little? And again, that's maybe one of those questions where I'll pretend like I'm an Austrian in that sense, right? I'll say, just enough to protect my rights. That's it.
So I think, yeah, but by definition, they're going to violate your rights as well. And now it's a question of, do you have more private, yes, private rights, yeah, violation or systematic government ones? And
yeah, what I agree. It's not 100%. I get it.
I think I like the big term classical liberal because it can include all of these positions. But I also think while it can include them, we need to recognize as people who are either advocates of anarcho-capitalism, minarchism, wherever you are, that these are legitimate questions to debate within the classical liberal tent. Because yes, if you care about liberty, there is an ideal to the anarcho-capitalist part of it.
Absolutely.
So the question is, how feasible is it? And I also don't think it's a everywhere yes and always question. It's a comparative institutional one. Given culture, ideology, economic situation, how bad is your anarchy or how good is your anarchy? And how bad is your state and how good is your state? And these, what we want to compare is real against real, not theoretical ideal minimal state versus theoretical anarchy. We want to compare what's our attainable actual minimal state in the United States today. What would be an attainable version of anarchy? What would those look like? Which one do we think is better? So this is relevant, actually, not so much for places like the United States, because I'll hear people say, oh, why debate these things? You know, tax rates are too high. We've got so many other things that we've got to. Well, I think one, it's important to know where you're going, but it's actually policy relevant for a lot of poorer countries. There's plenty of weak and failed states and plenty of international efforts to prop them up. And in many cases, these are predatory, what George Aidi, the African development economist, called vampire states that suck the lifeblood out of their people. And a lot of them would be better if they blow up and go away. But each one is, so I've done work on Somalia before, where, in fact, I went to one UN World Bank conference in Abu Dhabi years ago because of some of the stuff I wrote, and I was a wet blanket. They were all talking about how to rebuild the Somali nation state, and I got up and gave a talk about why they shouldn't. Because it appeared that people were doing better than when they had an extremely predatory government. And I said, what makes you think whatever you're writing down on paper here is going to be the government that sticks? Their entire history with formal external government has been colonialism that exploited them for resources, or for what resources they could get out of them. And then a socialistic kind of predatory dictatorship, right, where each clan vied to be in control and then oppressed the other clans. Now they've sorted out into an equilibrium where they have their own version of customary law. They have dispute resolution. They've effectively done national defense, kicking out international armies. Like, whatever you write down on paper, what makes you think it's going to look like that? Instead, it's going to look like the crappy state they had before, or the crappy states that are in its region around them that don't have much economic freedom, that don't have democratic freedom. Like, maybe for some of these, it's better off. But because that works better, does that equal anarchy for libertarians in the United States is better than U.S. government? No, that's a separate question. Each one of these is a comparative institutional question where it is that I think lovers of liberty should be interested in debating.
Excellent answer. I love it. Thank you for that, Ben. Okay, let's wrap up with a section of the show now that I refer to as silly questions. These are going to be five questions. There's no right or wrong answer. I'm going to shoot them out at you. Tell me what comes to mind. This is just to get folks to get a little bit of a greater appreciation and understanding for Dr. Benjamin Powell. Okay, first question. Which U.S. president do you feel did the greatest economic damage to the country, and who do you feel did the least?
William Henry Harrison did the least because he had the courtesy of giving a long speech, catching pneumonia, and dying before he could do much bad stuff.
Okay.
That said, he was a fan of Henry Clay's America System, so he probably would have done bad stuff if he had had time. But he wins the prize for that. Most damage. Oh, it's hard. And it's also the question of which one did the most damage. It's their personality, or is it the circumstances they found themselves in? So like Bill Clinton,
I'll let you decide.
Bill Clinton would have done a lot more damage, but he was president during the end of history where socialism fell, capitalism was on the rise. So he goes along to play. He ends up being one of my favorite presidents in my lifetime anyway. But it wasn't because he was inherently good. It's just he found himself in a situation that made him act more like things that I'd like.
Right place, right time, right?
Yeah. So I don't know. FDR is pretty bad.
Be my pick.
Biden's pretty bad right now. Trump was great on a lot of economic policies, but was really wrong on COVID to start with. But reverse course on that, at least in his rhetoric. But never fired Fauci. I guess probably FDR, but you know, there's predecessors to these things too. Lincoln did a lot of awful things too. There's a long list of bad guys here.
Okay, so let's pull it away from this by saying you don't think anybody really did a good job in history as president economically. You just cited to me the best guy is the guy who had the decency to die before he did any damage, right?
Well, he's the only one who never did anything I disagree with.
Right.
What I will say this is, to some extent, you got to give George Washington some props for turning down power that could have been his and setting up precedent of peaceful transition of power, two-term norm of limits, things that aren't necessarily essentially libertarian, but they do contribute to a relatively stable environment that's allowed us to be productive. So some props there.
Fair enough. If you could choose just one book to introduce free market principles to high school students, which one would it be?
I think they should read Socialism Sucks, and maybe some of them will get offended.
That's fair enough. Good answer. Okay. What's the most amusing analogy you've ever used to explain a complex economic theory? Is it maybe the friends drinking beer, and when there's a refund, they want to share it equally, but when it comes to paying, they feel their rich friend should pay?
No, I'm not coming up with a good one right now, and I'm sure I've done most. This is why I should drink during interviews. I'm more creative.
Okay. It's all right. If you can't come up with one now, that's okay. I put you on the spot. Okay. If economics were a pro wrestling match, who would win a triple threat match between Milton Friedman, Friedrich Hayek, and Murray Rothbard?
A triple threat match? What's a triple threat match?
Meaning they're all wrestling against each other simultaneously, all three in the ring at the same time. Who would end up being the last man standing?
Yeah, Hayek was the most athletically prowess of those three, so I'll go with Hayek then.
Which you wouldn't have known when you see him as an old man in all those where he's pontificating in all these YouTube videos, but I did not know that about Hayek, so that's cool. He was athletically gifted, you're saying,
compared to the
other two.
He was a big mountain hiker and climber. Milton did hike mountains, and play tennis, but he's obviously a lot smaller frame. And Murray was not in particularly great shape at any point in his life, I don't think.
I was just wondering if maybe being from Brooklyn gave him an edge, but okay.
If you had thrown Schumpeter in there, though, he probably would have been.
Well, he could have bored somebody to death before anybody.
Well, I don't know. He claimed to be the greatest horseman, best lover, and best economist in Europe.
Oh, really? I did not know that. Okay. I just read, what was that, his seminal book now? It's escaping me.
Capitalism, Socialism, and Democracy.
That was it, yeah. And it's very tough to get through. Like, it's that standard Austrian style of writing, that just never-ending sentences and whatnot. So he may have put someone to sleep. But okay, so it would have been Hayek, and if we had interference, it would have come from Schumpeter. Okay, last question. If Austrian economics were personified by a woman, which woman would that be?
I don't think I get the question.
Like, if you were to say Austrian economics, would it be like a seductress? Would it be a stern schoolmarm? Would it be a quiet librarian? What would it be?
Well, what it should be is a pretty cool chick who everyone wants to get to know.
Great answer. All right. Dr. Benjamin Powell, thank you so much for joining us here on the Big Questions with Big John. Please, if you have any books that are coming out, if you have a Twitter handle you want to promote or a website, please go ahead and do so for our audience.
All right, great. Thanks, Big John.
Do you have anything you want to promote, or a website or a Twitter handle?
Oh, yeah, sure. If you want to check out my stuff, BenjaminWPowell.com. Most of my stuff's up there, but go for Google Socialism Sucks, Two Economists Drink Their Way Through an Unfree World. We were a number 5 bestseller overall on Amazon, as well as the number 1 seller for a long time in socialism and communism, because some books are more equal than others, and also beer, which was not a goal that I set out for, but it is a life accomplishment.
Fantastic. Dr. Benjamin Powell, thank you so much for joining. Everyone else, please join us again the next time on the Big Questions with Big John right here at grumblingsmedia.com. You can find us everywhere on social media platforms. Just look up at Grumblings Media. Until next time.